Again, I'd like to start with thanking everybody for coming and thanking Professor Haicho and Professor Panevova for inviting me to this event and for me to be able to give this talk. I'll give an overview of our system, which is called ETAP 3. I think I'll concentrate on linguistic issues of it, just for the sake of linguists, because if I just give some technical characteristics, it would be one thing, but if I speak about certain lessons for linguists, that would be another thing. Okay, let me start. So as I said, it'll be about the linguistic processor and ETAP 3, which actually can be viewed as an NLP implementation of the meaning text theory. It is not exactly the case, because you couldn't say that what is in the theory is also in our system and the other way around. But still, there are a couple of important intersections. So, in a way, it can't be say so. It can't be said. It can't be said so. Theoretical foundations of the whole thing actually are twofold. As I said, it's the meaning text theory by Melchuk, and here you have some references to that theory. And another important source of the theory is that by Professor Aprisian, who engaged in lexicography to start with, and then offered the theory of integral description of language. It's not it is not a complicated theory. The main basis, thesis of the theory is very, very simple. It just says that the dictionary and the grammar of a language should match each other without any discrepancy, and which is regretfully not the case normally for many reasons, including historical ones. Everybody knows that lexicographers who compiled dictionaries, irrespective of the kind of these dictionaries, explanatory dictionaries, translational dictionaries, bilingual, trilingual, anything, they were hardly linguists. It is a really rare exception that a lexicographer is also a linguist, especially a good one. In Aprisian's case, it was exactly this exception, because he always worked as a theoretical scientist, and besides, he devoted very much of his time to compiling different types of dictionaries. And as soon as we started working on an application, the first application was machine translation, it was quite essential that this idea about matching the dictionaries and the grammar was quite important. The system has a few applications. Machine translation is one of them. Now, the second main part thereof is deeply annotated text corpus called Syntegris. There is also a translation system based on universal networking language interlingua. There is a system of synonymous and quasi-synonymous paraphrasing of utterances, which was put to some practical use in recent past. There is a computer-aided language learning tool made almost exclusively by Aprisian, based on the notion and proliferation of the system of lexical functions, And there are some new developments about semantics and ontologies that we have just started. Maybe I'll have a couple of minutes to say a few words about these developments. But mostly I'd like to concentrate on the first two issues, on machine translation for one, and on the Syntegris tree bank for the other. So I'll speak about machine translation first, and then we'll continue. The main two languages that the system works with are Russian and English, both ways. I must admit that the Russian to English version is better developed than the English to Russian one, even though historically English to Russian preceded that. For some particular reasons. First, it was because we had better resources and better experience when dealing with Russian, because it was not it was our later option. And second, because the main part of the machine translation system, dealing from working from Russian into English, was substantially reused in the creation of the tree bank. So it is very heavily connected. Therefore, we had to devote much of our time to the development of the parsing for Russian. So at the end, the Russian to English option of machine translation turned out to be more developed. There are a couple of other prototypes, as you see here. An Arabic to English prototype was the recent one. It was quite interesting because it was made on the same principles as other languages, and the source language you see was Arabic. It was quite interesting because you know that Arabic morphology is absolutely different from the morphology of Slavic languages and other European languages, in that it has these transfixes that penetrate the root, forming specific, forming a specific word form. And we were able to reuse the notion of alternations that present in Slavic languages to extrapolate on Arabic, and it was quite useful to students students of Arabic did that and were quite successful. They were not Arabic students, they were Russian students who learned Arabic at the university. Okay, I'm going to speak about Russian and English. Maybe a couple of technical details about the major features of the whole environment. First, it's rule-based approach. However obsolete and outdated it may sound today, we have some statistical crutches, so to say, but only a few of them, and they are minor and secondary. The approach is purely stratificational, which means that we have very clearly defined strata or layers or levels of English of language representation. Important idea is that the syntactic structure is presented in the form of syntactic dependencies, and to be even more particular, in the form of syntactic dependency trees, which is quite a strong restriction, but then it turned out to be a useful one for many reasons. The other feature I would call lexicalistic approach, because the dictionary is the focus of our attention. We pay, we made very much effort to develop our dictionaries, and we have ramified information in the dictionary. Maybe a technical feature of the environment is that it can boast of self-tuning. to the sentence being processed. Namely, what happens is that the rules are distributed among several layers. One of the layers is that some of the rules are general. They are applied to every sentence. Other rules are template rules that are only applied if the sentence has words of certain classes or even individual words. In other cases, these rules are not even applied. Strive at maximum reusability of linguistic resources. As I said, we use this, use the parsing and the dictionaries in other applications, including the tree bank. And on the other hand, it is important that we have the same dictionaries for both directions of translation. So if we have an English dictionary, then we should be sure that this dictionary is used as a source dictionary in the English to Russian machine translation, and it is also used as the target dictionary in the Russian to English machine translation. It's one and the same dictionary, only there are several specific zones that are responsible for particular tasks, but the main part of the dictionary is monolingual. So just a couple of words about self-tuning. There are general regularities, for instance, general rules that apply to very large classes. For instance, if we have to cover the phenomenon of agreement, it's a general rule. And if we cover to the phenomenon R, an example of compound numerals, it is a very restricted scope rule. That can only apply to certain classes of words, namely numerals. The general architecture of translation processes follows. I'm not going to go into big details. However, let us see how it happens. Perhaps the word phrase is out of place here. I should have written sentence, but then. It's clear what it is all about. We translate everything, and we do everything, including the tree bank, sentence by sentence. We very seldom go beyond the sentence. We do not deal with complete texts, even though we have some rules to brush. We have some rules that are responsible for brushing up the output depending on the text. But mainly, it's within the sentence, even though the sentence may be really complicated and long. So as soon as we obtain a sentence, we start with its morphological analysis, using the morphological dictionary for that purpose. And if we have the morphological structure, it will be ambiguous. So every single part of the morphological structure is the object that has unresolved ambiguity. It may be lexical ambiguity, it may be morphological ambiguity, it may be both. We do have some extra rules, which we call pre-syntactic rules, that are used to partially resolve ambiguity according to linear context only. But these rules are very limited and only clear up very obvious ambiguities. Otherwise, the whole morphological structure is ambiguous. Only then do we start with the parsing, in the course of which we try to resolve all ambiguity, so that every structure, every syntactic structure is 100% disambiguated. This does not mean that the first structure obtained is the correct or the optimal one, but it is the only one. We strive, of course, to do everything in such a way that the first structure is normally the most expected one, the most appropriate one, but it's not always that we succeed. So as soon as we have the structure, we subject it to a couple of intermediate processing steps. So the syntactic structure that we obtain is normalized. By normalization, I mean here certain procedures that strip the structure of certain national-specific features of the source language. So, for instance, if we go from Russian to English or from Russian to elsewhere, we strip the Russian structure of certain specific feature. Like, for instance, Russian has this peculiar approximative construction with the reversed word order. So we say "столов пять," literally, tables five, which means approximately five tables or about five tables. And this shouldn't be carried to other languages, so we normalize the structure in this respect. Also, normally, we strip the structure of all strongly governed prepositions and conjunctions. And also, if we speak about English, for instance, as the source language, we strip the sentence of articles. Of course, we do not just delete them. We process these articles developing certain specific features, but these features are not with the articles. They go to the nouns or other words that had these articles. Then, after the structure is normalized, we go to the transfer, which is to be understood that we do not go as far as the semantic level as such. We make a shortcut, proceed from the assumption that syntactic structures of the input and the output languages are close enough for a match to be achievable. Of course, it is not always so. Sometimes the restructuring of the source syntactic structure is something of a feat, but in most situations it is quite okay. Now, after we have obtained the syntactic structure of the target language, we make another procedure, which is in a way opposite to normalization, which is called expansion. So we produce some of the peculiarities of the target language, like introducing articles in English or introducing the approximative construction in Russian or restoring, actually building anew strongly governed prepositions and conjunctions, etc. After that, the structure is ready for syntactic synthesis, syntactic generation, which means that we have to generate outstanding morphological features that are not in the structure for certain reasons. For instance, we have not yet applied all agreement rules or rules of government. These are applied, and outstanding features are generated and added to the structure, and then we are only left with the morphological synthesis, that is, substituting the morphological structure for substituting the real written form of a word for its morphological representation. I don't think if I should give you examples of machine translation work. Perhaps I'll do that later on when I come to demonstration. But so far, it's quite clear. Importantly, we use in all our applications the notion of lexical functions. I am not sure that I have to reiterate what lexical functions are, but since not everyone is expected to know much about that, I'll just say a couple of words. Lexical functions were invented by Melchuk and Jalkowski, his co-author, back in 1960s. The idea was that there are quite a few very general senses that are expressed in the language in a rather idiomatic way. There are two types of lexical functions, namely the substitute lexical functions like synonyms or antonyms or converse terms or derivatives, and the so-called collocate lexical functions like magon and many other things. The difference being that a lexical function of the first class is actually paradigmatic. So if you have one word, it is hardly to be expected that one such word of the substitute class would appear in the same sentence. Of course, you can imagine a sentence where there is a word and then its synonym for some emphasis or some clarification, but it's not a normal case. And as far as collocations are concerned, this is an absolutely conventional and popular and regular mechanism. Suppose if we have one word and we need to express this, to express one of these broad senses, like for instance the sense to a high degree, we expect that many sentences would have instances of such lexical functions. Now, a concrete example of a concrete lexical function. Just imagine that you have to describe a certain object or event as having the high degree. If we speak about a disease, the English would say that a disease is grave. If we speak about fog, that the English would say that it is heavy, and not the other way around. They would not. We would never say that it's a heavy disease or a grave fog. And also, if we speak about control, it would not be grave, it would not be heavy, or maybe it would be heavy, but strict control is the best. Is the best term for that. And if we take the other language, for instance, Russian, then for болезнь, which is disease, we will have the adjective тяжелый, which is literally heavy. For туман, we will have густой, and not heavy. It is impossible to say something like тяжелый туман. Or if we can, that would be some play or game with the language. It would be a very important metaphor, but not the normal way of doing these things. As far as control is concerned, it will be the same. So these lexical functions turn out to be most helpful in many applications, including machine translation. So Magon was very simple, and I'll give you a very general feel of another important class of lexical functions, namely the oper and funk family of lexical functions. Just imagine a situation which we could describe with the word invitation. You understand that the invitation is a situation that requires two actants. The word invitation has two valences, and respectively, the words that instantiate these two valences are its actants, and it requires two actants, the one who invites and the one who is invited. Just imagine that if the first actant of invitation is instantiated by the word minister, and the second actant thereof is instantiated by the word ambassador, that would mean that the minister invites the ambassador. Okay, this situation can be represented in lots of ways, using support or semi-support verbs. For instance, if the ambassador invites the minister, we may say that if the minister invites the ambassador, we may say that the minister issues an invitation to the ambassador, and the ambassador receives the invitation from the minister. It comes to the same thing, but the words are different: issues and receives. I'll give you a couple of examples of these functions so that you could have a better understanding of what it is all about. Oper 1 of invitation is issue, you already saw that, while oper 2 of invitation is receive. That is, oper is just the support verb that connects keyword, the argument of the lexical function, namely invitation, with its value, receive, so that invitation is the first object of this verb, receive, whereas the subject would be exactly the first actant. If the invitation is issued, then it is the minister who issues the invitation. If invitation is received, it is the ambassador who receives the invitation. Oper 1 of defeat is suffer. Well, it's a controversial case because you don't exactly know whether you really have to think of defeat as the opposite of victory, or else as a synonym of victory. It's quite a controversial situation because the words win and defeat are more of a couple of synonyms rather than antonyms. He won, this team defeated the other team. Again, it seems the same. As far as the noun defeat is concerned, maybe it's different. But we still think that oper 1 of defeat is suffer, and so on. And oper 2 of resistance is encounter resistance. So you understand that if there is a resistance, somebody resists somebody else, and this second person, second person encounters his resistance. Or oper 2 of respect is enjoy. Somebody enjoys somebody's respect. And as far as funk is concerned, it's the opposite function, where in all these cases, the argument of the function, invitation, defeat, resistance, and respect, acted as the complement of the verbs: receive an invitation, suffer defeat, encounter resistance, enjoy one's respect. In this case, it's the other way around. Funk is the function where the argument, that is the keyword, is the subject of the verb. Fear possesses somebody, or decision concerns. This decision concerned many people. Decision is the subject of the verb concern. Or the responsibility rests with somebody. Or vengeance falls upon somebody. and etc., etc. General properties of lexical functions are, among other things, there, its universality, its intralinguistic idiomaticity. You saw about you saw that when we spoke about this Magen function. For instance, you say grave disease and heavy fog, but not the other way around. And it's also cross-linguistic idiomaticity, because you say тяжелая болезнь, густой туман, and if we just tried to match these words with literal equivalents in English, it would be wrong. So it's idiomatic both within one language and across languages. It's good. Lexical functions have good paraphrasing potential. For instance, if you say something like "he respects his teachers," we may change it into "he has respect for his teachers," substituting certain lexical functions, and make a couple of other changes, like using the noun "respect" instead of the verb. Of the verb respect, he respects his teachers. He has respect for his teachers, or he treats his teachers with respect. So these are types of lexical functions, or his teachers enjoy his respects. And this paraphrasing potential is very important, let alone fact that all this paraphrasing potential somehow corresponds with human ability to express one and the same thing with many synonymous words. In practical applications, lexical functions are applied in order to resolve syntactic and lexical ambiguity in parsers, for instance. And they guarantee, or enable at least, idiomatic translation of a large class of set expressions. Just a very short example. Let's take an expression like "draw a distinction." And in Russian that would be «проводить различие». Both verbs, the English and the Russian ones, are extremely ambiguous. If you just take WordNet, you'll find over 50 meanings for draw, and if you take a big dictionary of Russian, you will take more than 10 meanings for проводить. But as soon as we have this, if we have this instance of a lexically lexical function collocation, automatically this will resolve this lexical ambiguity. We only take one meaning of draw and one meaning of проводить. Besides, even the words distinction and различие may also be there, but I'm not going into these details. If we take some expression like support of the army, it could, of course, be interpreted either as support by the army or support to the army. And it is, in many cases, difficult to disambiguate. However, if we have specific lexical functions there, then it would be quite easily disambiguated. So, for instance, if we have the expression like "the president had the support of the army," then understanding that the verb "have" is one of the values of the oper 2 function of support, then we may invent and apply the rule that in this case only one interpretation of this prepositional phrase "of the army" is in place, namely the support of the army as the agent and not as the patient or object of that. This is a rather exotic example, but I hope you'll understand it. The fear of his wife possessed Peter. You remember that possessed was given as an example of funk of a lexical function for wife. Actually, the fear of his wife may mean two things. Either that the wife fears something, the wife is afraid, or else somebody is afraid of one's wife. The fear of his wife. Now, if we have this funk one, the fear of his wife possessed Peter, it can only mean that he was afraid of his wife and nothing else. It is impossible that the fear that his wife had somehow spread unto Peter. It doesn't do anything like that. So we can have this meaning in this expression, the fear of his wife infected Peter, that would be quite possible. Okay, so it's quite interesting and unexpected in most respects. Now that we have such a rule and we apply it, and all of a sudden we get a good interpretation. As far as idiomatic translation is concerned, it can be demonstrated with very simple but very obvious examples. Like, for instance, if we have a specific lexical function temp that speaks about moments of time. We can say in English, in March, on Tuesday, at dawn, at the moment, or at Easter. And if we choose the same, if we need to choose the respective prepositions in other languages, they would be very different and sometimes very unexpected. Why two, where one is there? It is because these are different prepositions that govern different cases. Where two subcategorizes for the prepositional case, в марте, and where one subcategorizes for the accusative case, во вторник. In many cases, I'd like to say even, in most cases, this is semantically unmotivated. You just have to memorize what is to be said, but with the help of the lexical function temp, it is quite easy to do. So we do not translate in March or on Tuesday. We translate it in the following way. We find the lexical function temp. So instead of in March, we will have temp plus March. Then March will be translated, and then we'll go into the word of mart and find the value for the lexical function temp. It will find that it'll be v 2, and we'll just substitute this value, and that'll be okay. Sentence paraphrasing. I don't think I'll have to go into details. Already spoken about that. And now I'd like to give you some lessons of machine translation. Why should I do that? Actually, our system of machine translation is very specific. It is an application that is hardly used in practice. Well, of course, it's an exaggeration. Sometimes it is used in practice. Even I, as a translator, sometimes use it to get rough translation, and it's quite useful in many cases. But we always thought of it really as a testing ground, as a testing bed to verify or correct some of our theories. So, for instance, if we write rules of parsing, these rules are written with regard to the grammar that we have in mind. And if the grammar is written well, then the rules will be well. And more often than not, it happens that we have a feedback of the system saying, for instance, that the rule is actually not very good, in which case we have to correct these rules. And sometimes it so happens that the rule has never been formulated in any resource for the language, not in theoretical grammar, not in the dictionary, and not elsewhere. So I'll give you an example. I wonder if you could understand it. Maybe some background knowledge of Russian is presupposed, but maybe on the other hand, you will be able to see all that. Actually, I must say that when we experimented with the machine translation system, we used certain types of texts that are especially of advantage in machine translation. For instance, news lines, internet news lines. For instance, there is the news agency Itar Tass in Russia. That gives you news lines and internet. They are good because all these pieces of news are very short. They consist of one or at maximum two sentences. They are written in a very good literary language, with very few mistakes, very thoroughly worked out, and quite importantly, they concern any subjects because it's news, and news may concern everything. News that was in Itar Tass, and it was as follows: Власти Афганистана издали распоряжение, согласно которому вооруженным лицам предписано покинуть Кабул. It was back in 2001 or 2 when the Americans first came to Afghanistan. And all of a sudden we obtain the translation that is absolutely unreadable and inadequate. Actually, the sentence should have meant the following: the authorities of Afghanistan issued a decree or published an order according to which armed people have to abandon Kabul. What we get, you see on the screen. Authorities of Afghanistan have published an order. It is prescribed to according to which armed persons to abandon Kabul. Makes no sense. And it's not just bad English. It really makes no sense. Okay, we tried to find, this is not a very complicated sentence. We tried, we started to research what happened, and found out immediately that we have a wrong syntactic structure. You may have a closer look and see that this group, согласно которому, in accordance to which, and it was the decree in accordance to which it was prescribed. So, согласно которому did not depend, was not related to предписывать, to prescribe, but for some reason it was related to вооружать, to arm. You remember they were armed people. So, armed in accordance with which? And it is impossible. Why is it impossible? We didn't know. First, we thought that maybe this word "katori," which is very far from the head of the relative clause. But then we found out, of course, we know it, that there are things where the arboreal context of "katori" is really very long. Человек с женой одного из старших братьев которого я хорошо знаком. Something like the man with the wife of one of the elder brothers of which I am very well acquainted. So it's quite possible, and nothing of the sort. So if you have the bracket structure of this source sentence, you will understand what it is all about. So there is one internal structure, старших братьев которого. Where is that? The internal bracket. Well, everything like that. I'm not going into details. It is quite clear. So, and you see that the syntactic structure is quite okay. And you see there are six steps until we have six steps of the tree. So it's not the case. Now we thought about that and tried to understand if there is any meaning in that. So instead of "который," we just thought maybe it means распоряжение. с вооруженной согласно распоряжению, armed in accordance with the order. In accordance with the order, it is quite possible some people could be armed exactly in accordance with the order, obtain such and such equipment, such and such rifles and everything like that. But of course, it's not what is meant here. If we just translated, if we just made it into two sentences, it would be quite understandable. The authorities of Afghanistan issued an order. People who are armed in accordance to this order have to leave Kabul. Why not? But then we had an insight. Actually, that participles cannot appear in the syntactic string of words that separate the head node of the attributive clause from the pronoun katori. It is strange. It is never, and it is never written that such a rule exists. When I thought about that, I thought that perhaps I am absolutely wrong because there is nothing that should account for that. Still, I tried to find out whether it is possible, and I found out that indeed it is absolutely impossible. So this sentence, малыш, позвавший которого дядя, пошел купаться, по-прежнему возился в песке. It's an invented example. I tried to invent something in order to disprove this suggestion because I thought it was wrong. Something like the kid whose uncle who called him when bathing was still playing in the sand. The English sentence is maybe acceptable. The Russian one is absolutely unacceptable and incomprehensible. Or something like that. Это ученый, сделанное которым открытие произвело переворот науки. This is a scientist, a discovery made by whom made a revolution in science. Well, in English, that will be out of the question. But then it is associated with the word order, and in Russian, the word order is, in this respect, free, but it still is impossible. I'm skipping this contradiction. Okay, so we introduce this rule into our parsing system, namely this ban on the word katori to appear between. To appear within the relative clause. As soon as you've done that, lo and behold, the sentence is analyzed perfectly in a perfectly correct way, and we obtain the correct structure, согласно которому, in accordance to which is related to предписывать, prescribe, and everything there. And the translation is okay, and that's it. Then we started thinking maybe there are other things about this katori appearance, and we found out very soon that not only participles but also finite verbs can interfere. It was also strange, but it was found to be quite okay. It was found to be quite the case. Это писатель, которым интересуется и даже восхищается современная молодежь. It's quite okay. This is a writer in whom modern young people take an interest and whom they even admire. That's okay. But if we change the word order and put katori after this finite verb, It'll make nonsense. This is the right to modern young people take an interest in and whom they admire. Of course, it's nonsense. So we had to introduce that also. Strangely enough, the string of words between the head of the attributive clause and the word katori cannot contain any conjunctions. And this is a very strange, actually a very strange phenomenon. Это был мастер, подобно которому не работал никто и никогда. This was an expert like who nobody ever worked. It's quite all right. Подобно in this case is not a conjunction. It is a preposition. And it's quite okay. But as soon as we change this подобно into a very similar conjunction, как or словно, as, well, словно is also as if, as though. It would be impossible. Это был мастер, как который никто не работал. Out of the question. So it's another thing. So what happened was one silly mistake made us understand very many things about the Russian syntax. Well, of course, people who wrote about that much earlier than ourselves. You know that many linguists, including a famous Russian linguist Sherba, always wrote that so-called negative linguistic material is very valuable. So if somebody makes a mistake, it can be valuable in order to find out certain language regularities. But machine translation output as a negative linguistic material is also very, very valuable, and even more valuable, because no man is ever able to produce such silly things as machine translation, as machine parsing does. Okay, that was one example. The second example. How much time do I? Okay, right. Very well, thank you. 15. Okay, I'll try to squeeze everything into these 15 minutes. Thank you very much. Another interesting example, I would say, happened when we worked with another day of this newsreel of Tartas. It was hardly news, but still there was the expression like «Главная цель великого поста, который начался для православных, нравственно возвысить человека». The more or less literal translation would look like the chief aim of the Lent. Lent is the, you understand what Lent is, which has begun for the Orthodox, and then it is moral to raise a person. What happened? The second part, нравственно возвысить человека, was viewed as a whole assertion, as a whole sentence, rather than an infinitival clause. And why not? It is quite possible. Taken separately, this is possible. Maybe the meaning is strange, but the syntax is okay. What happened was that the word цель, aim or purpose, is improper here. It cannot be combined with things like цель. Why? It is difficult to say. If we paraphrased the target sentence, the chief aim of the Lent is that raising a person is moral, that would be, of course, bad. So this part of sentence, as I said, was viewed as a sentence rather than the infinitive group. If we modify the syntactic structure, which we could do thanks to the multiple translation potentials of our system, then everything would be okay. Okay, now we started to study the things and find out that if we substitute other words for purpose, for цель, everything would be okay. So instead of цель, purpose, if we took instead of цель, if we inserted the word idea, that would be perfectly correct. So what actually happened? The word цель, words цель and idea, purpose and idea, are really very close. It is very difficult to understand that their syntactic behavior is quite different. But then it turned out that it really is so. So what we tried to do, actually, was to find out what other words share or do not share this purpose, property. And we come to understand that in addition to purpose, there will be other things. The Russian list is over, and the English list is also quite quite impressive. Aim, purpose, goal, intent, task, plan, intention, aspiration. All these words cannot subcategorize an assertion. They can only subcategorize an infinitive phrase. Of course, you will say that it should be semantically motivated, but on the surface of it, it looks as if it is a syntactic peculiarity, a syntactic feature. We have lots of syntactic features. I'm not going into details because I have no time. But when we introduced a specific feature, we call it prep, that is the feature that enables one to have the whole sentence if that word, like idea or thought, is the subject of that whole sentence. The idea is, and so on and so forth. Okay? So we introduced this feature. We made a rule that accounted for that feature. This rule, feature was not ascribed to the word purpose, and we couldn't, and we were able to get rid of this wrong interpretation. So that was quite okay. The last thing that I want, the last lesson that I wanted to draw from the the machine translation, it's not actually the answer, it's the question, is statistic omnipotent? Well, and my answer would be definitely no. Let me say a few things about that. At different moments of our machine translation work, we obtained several strange translations. So, на месте пожара был обнаружен мертвым пожилой сторож. On the spot of the fire, an elderly guard was found dead. What we did was, what we obtained was an elderly guard was found on the side of the fire by the dead man. Okay, обнаружен мертвым is of course the instrumental case, and the instrumental case is normal for the agent. So it was a dead man who found the elderly guard. How could you get rid of this interpretation? You couldn't just say that dead people can do anything. Of course they can. They cannot detect anything, but they can frighten somebody. All right? So they are very good agents in this case. On the other hand, you may also say that it is a retrospective sentence. So in this, there was something about a person who died or was killed later on, and it was he who found this elderly guard. So just imagine that there was some man who found the elderly guard dead, and some the criminal who killed the elderly guard found that man and killed him later on too. And in this case, it would be quite acceptable. The only thing I want to say is that it is that it cannot be excluded by purely rule-based mechanisms. And this is where statistics should come into play. But because, of course, if you think something about that, you will. If you match these parallel texts, as all these statistical translation systems do, you will expect, of course, that would be okay. Very well. That was one example. Another example was as follows: было потоплено 820 домовладений. It was also in the Intertas newsreel. Потоплено is the ambiguous word that could mean either flooded or else heated a little. Подтопить, heat a little. Just imagine there were houses, it is winter, and it was so cold that you had to heat as many as 820 houses. Why not? Of course, this will be no news. No Itartas agency would write about the things that that some people heated their houses because it was cold. But how do you formalize that? because semantically it's absolutely correct. Of course, it's again the material for statistics. And one more sentence, which was very funny. It was в 1999 году в ФРГ переехало 95 тысяч этнических немцев. I hope you understand what it means. In 1999, into FRG, that is Federal Republic of Germany, moved 95,000 ethnic Germans. Okay, the translation was such. 95,000 ethnic Germans were run over. Because переехало is an ambiguous word. So some car ran over these people, poor people. Okay, how can you exclude this interpretation? Only because you know that the world is not as bad as to have 95,000 people a year being run over by cars. Again, that would be the issue for statistics, because you know when you speak about something like переехало, that would really concern actually moving, immigration, and everything like that, rather than cars. If there were 95,000 переехало двух немцев, it would be okay. So two Germans were run over, but not as many. Besides, there is some lucky or unlucky coincidence, because FRG here is morphologically ambiguous. It may be accusative case into Federal Republic, or else prepositional case within Federal Republic. If we substituted Германию for that, Germany, that would be different, because the accusative and the prepositional cases are different. Okay. And that was it. So it is difficult to do something really really reasonable with the rule-based system. Maybe I'll just say a few words about very difficult cases for lexical ambiguity. I'll take three words: акция, лицо, and партия, that are very difficult to tackle. Акция has two meanings. It's either a public event, like demonstration, or else a share. You buy a share in some enterprise or stock, it is called акция. So it may be a share of an enterprise, or it's an action, activity. Полиция разогнала студенческую акцию. So what happened? The translation was the police have accelerated the student share. What happened? Well, разогнала is also ambiguous. It's either accelerate neutrons or elementary particles or whatever. And акция, I already said what it is. Semantically, this interpretation is much better than the real one, because разогнать is the verb that requires a physical object, and акция as a share is a piece of paper, which means a physical object. So you can just accelerate this action. As far as the other thing is concerned, when you say акция, it's an activity, and you cannot disperse an activity. It's a metaphoric use of activity as a crowd, as those who take part in this activity. It is difficult to understand. Again, that would be the material for statistical approach. Okay. So of course, if we resorted to interactive disambiguation, which we are able to do, it would be quite okay. Okay, the next thing would be лицо, which is really very complex, because there are two words of лицо. One is part of head or face, and the second is person in all senses of the world. It may be a man or a human, or else it's a grammatical person. Okay. Now you have different word combinations: круглое лицо, round face; ideal traits of the face, a face with a scar, it would be face. So it's just, we can feed all this into our rules. Or physical person or legal body, physical body or legal body or official body or just an official. A signature by an official. People who are who do not belong here are forbidden to enter, and so on. However, it is difficult to understand what a familiar face or an unfamiliar face would mean when you say that I saw an unfamiliar face. Actually, it means that I so an unfamiliar person, not an unfamiliar face. And this is also already a complication. And if we say something metaphorically like the customs is the face of the state or the person of the state, that's very, very difficult because the customs is the legal body, and then semantically, it should correspond to the second meaning of litso, namely the body, the legal body, not the face. And of course, it is translated as the face of the state and nothing else. And you remember that официальное лицо, that will be the official person. And if he made, that would not be the official person. It would be the official, he would draw a face was customary for an official. And if we have something like partia рабов, that would mean either a party of slaves or else a batch of slaves. And it is difficult to understand what is meant. And in this case, it would be the party of workers and not a batch of workers. So it's quite difficult. And if you speak about partia skripki, which it is the part of violin and not the party or batch. And partia skripak would amount to a different partia skripki, that would be the part of violin, and partia skripak would be a batch of violins. And it is quite difficult to understand all these. Again, let us hope that it is all food for statistics. Let's see what happens. Google Translation, the translator, which is absolutely statistical, and it is very good because it the whole world is the basis for its statistics. Полиция разогнала студенческую акцию. Police dispersed the student share. Полиция разогнала акции протеста студентов. Police dispersed the protest students. Action акции are absolutely unknown. In this case, in 1999, Germany moved to 95,000 ethnic Germans. Of course, there was nothing about running over. But the idea is absolutely makes no sense. Было потоплено 820 домовладений. Well, it was quite okay. Or maybe it was not really good English, but it was okay. In place of the fire was discovered by the late middle-aged watchman. So the same mistake was made by statistical ways. There was strangely enough, it was покойный, the late, it was this one. Мертвый, that was better. In place of the fire, was found dead an elderly watchman. Interestingly enough, the same thing is here, пожилой сторож. Here it is correct, an elderly watchman. And in here, пожилой сторож, is a middle-aged watchman, which is not what is meant. Why? I don't know. Моих друзей зовут Петя и Маша. That's one of my favorite examples. Actually, the sentence "Моих друзей зовут Петя и Маша" may have two meanings. Either my friends' names are Петя and Маша, or else with the other meaning of the word "зовут" that would be some absolutely different thing. Петя and Маша are calling my friends to do something, for instance. So my friend's name is Petya and Masha. And if you say something like, моих друзей звали Петр и Мария в кино, that would mean that Peter and Maria called my friends to go to the cinema. That was what Google Translator did. My friend's name was Peter and Mary in film, and in our case, we would have done better. So it is all about machine translation and about the lessons that could be drawn from it. I will now very briefly speak about Syntegris, which is our tree bank, and I hope that it is of interest to people, especially to people here who work with the Prague Dependency Tree Bank. These banks are quite similar. You see that the tree bank contains over 42,000 sentences. Of course, it is not much. It amounts to 600,000 words. But then you must understand that it is syntactically tagged, and it's quite a bit of manual work, really manual work. The texts are of a variety of genres. I'm not going to read that because you've already seen that. And it is an autonomous part of the Russian national corpus. It can be freely consulted on the web. And you understand, of course, that it is dependency-based annotations scheme in a way parallel to the Prague Dependency Tree Bank. So that's the syntactic representation of every sentence of the corpus. I'm not going to discuss all these elements of the syntactic representation in details because it will take much time. But what I'd like to say that we have nodes that represent lemmas that are assigned morphological and part of speech tags. And arcs of these dependency trees are labeled with names of syntactic dependencies or syntactic links. And the tagging nowadays uses about 75 syntactic links, which, if I'm not mistaken, three times as much as the Prague corpus. But it is of minor difference because, after all, these dependencies may be made as detailed as possible. Half of them proposed in Igor Melchuk's theory, and many of them were developed later on. Interestingly enough, normally one token corresponds to one node of the dependency tree, but there are quite a few exceptions, like as follows. There are composite words like 50-etajny, 50-storied, which is divided into two words where one token, word written together, corresponds to two or more nodes, because we just segment it into parts. There are so-called phantom nodes for the representation of hard cases of ellipses, which do not correspond to any particular token in the sentence. For instance, if you take a sentence like, I bought a shirt and he a tie, it's an exact Russian equivalent of the sentence. It will be expanded into I bought a shirt and he bought a tie, because otherwise the structure would be so bizarre that nobody would benefit from it. We'll have to introduce something in order for this sentence to be okay. And there are multi-word expressions like at least, по крайней мере, where several tokens correspond to one node. It is also a very frequent case. We use a large dictionary that has 130,000 entries that underlies the corpus. And the morphological analyzer uses the dictionary to produce annotations of words belonging to the corpus, which includes the lemma, POS tags, part of speech, and a set of morphological features. The markup language is, of course, XML, because It must feature several layers of linguistic data that can be extracted from the annotation, and XML allows for that. It should be incrementable, both quantitatively and qualitatively, so that new types of information could be added easily. And they are really added quite often. For instance, we introduced recently lexical functional annotation with lexical functions and lexical semantic annotation. It must be supplied by standard programming means for text parsing and everything like that, and XML is okay. To do all that, we've developed a very interesting device called Structure Editor, which is aimed at automatic generation of morphosyntactic and lexical functional annotation of texts, manual editing of these, and fully manual annotation. Of course, automatic generation is only possible for the languages that are in ETAP, even though theoretically it is absolutely language independent. We can do anything with it if we have rules for this language. There are different types of dialogues. I'm just skipping all that. Maybe I'll show you one more thing. So this is actually the XML source for which everything is tagged. Пётр крепко спит. Peter sleeps soundly. Is represented with these tags. This is the opening sentence tag. This is the closing sentence tag. This is the opening word tag. This is the closing word tag, and so on and so forth. Actually, the sentence parsers are quite observable. Suppose this is an average complexity sentence. It's quite long, but not complicated. And you see all these representations that look quite okay, and you can work with that. Lexical functional annotation is done either automatically or manually. It is a very new development and also a partial one. It's not for the whole corpus, but for a part of the corpus, for the new one. For instance, in this case, техника вызывает удивление, causes surprise у многих специалистов, in many specialists. So, вызывать is the value of the causfunct 1 lexical function whose argument is удивление. And the preposition u, in, is the context of this lexical function, and it can be very well seen. This is the so-called intellectual debugger is a good device that allows one to correct and verify the whole thing at once. I have regretfully no time to show how it works, but maybe I'll have 1 or 2 minutes for demonstration. I'll do that. The last thing that I wanted to tell you about is something new that we started within our big top 3 system. We started work associated with semantics and ontologies in order to make something really helpful. There are ontologies. We tried to reuse an ontology and build upon this ontology a semantic system that would enable us to produce reasonable semantic analysis of the analysis of texts and situations. One of our PhD students, Lana Timoshenko, even chose an interesting application for that. It was a very narrow subject domain. The subject domain that she chose was sports, and particularly the idea of chess competitions. Not just chess, because the area would be too large. Only chess competitions. What happens? Where is the championship or some memorial or some round and everything like that? And out of these news concerning chess competitions, we tried to find out whether we can do some logical inferences. We never did that, and tried to find out what there is in literature, and soon found out that many things are missing at all and have to be developed anew. I'll give you two examples of this. In Russian, there is an expression called "выходной день." The literal, the normal translation of "выходной день" is "day off," the place where nobody works or nobody works. Like it's more or less close to weekend. Он работал выходной день. He worked on a weekend. Maybe it's Saturday or Sunday. However, it turned out that it is not so simple, because in all these applications, we have to know with relation to whom this выходной день is considered. It's not just a Saturday or a Sunday. It's a day off for somebody else, for some concrete person. Сегодня выходной день у Ивана. Иван has his day off today. But all of a sudden, it is not so simple as that, because on the other hand, you can, in many contexts, see выходной день as rather an equivalent of Saturday or Sunday. For instance, магазин был закрыт, потому что выходной день магазина не работает. The shop was closed because on weekends the shops are closed, something like that. But it was not only the end. When we spoke about выходной день, about these participants of chess events, of chess competitions, then it turned out that there are different days off for players, for participants of the championship, and for the championship itself. And it is incredibly difficult to understand what is what. And we have to invent special rules and special semantic objects for that. And another example would be ход. Ход is the move, the move in chess. We may say that somebody surrendered during the tenth move. What does that mean? Actually, we have to know how chess moves are counted. Every chess move consists of two half moves, so to say. So the whites make one move, that will be move number one. The black gives the other move, that will be again move number two, and so on. So if somebody surrendered at move 10, it would be different to understand. It would be we will have to understand what happened. Was it in the 90th half move or in the 20th half move? It will depend on whether this man played black or white. But that's one thing. And suppose we could have decided that this hod is a specific feature of chess, which it is. But then it is not always like that, because if you said Гроссмейстер сделал ход, the grandmaster made a move, it is not one of the half moves, it was just one move, and you had to distinguish between them and somehow introduce that. So all these, and of course all these semantic objects are not to be found in any dictionaries or in any ontologies for that matter. They have to be developed anew. These two last examples are not from chess, from chess system, but larger sports system. Столичная Динамо выиграла у своих ростовских одноклубников. The sentence is absolutely difficult to understand. Why? Столичная means relating to the capital. So, Динамо that is situated in the capital, but you don't know what the country of these what the country is to for which this capital is counted. It may be Moscow, it may be something else, you don't know. Because you know, for instance, that there is the Dinamo, the football the football team, the very famous football team is in Kyiv. Kyiv is the capital of Ukraine, so we don't know what Stolichny means. Now, Odnoklubniki is the team that has the same name. How do you, so you have to somehow understand that if you say Rostovsky, that is belonging to Rostov, that's another city, and somehow made an inference that the Dinamo that belonged to one country, whatever country, you don't know, won or defeated Rostov company, Rostov team made, Rostov team named Dinamo. And it is quite difficult to do, but as soon as we've done that, we can introduce that into a database, we obtain a fact, and on this fact, we can then build our new developments. Okay, maybe I'm not going to discuss the second paragraph. So the overview is over. If you allow me one more minute, I'll just show you just show you this Syntegris in its real work. If not, then we'll just call it a day. Well, maybe I'll just show that. Actually, this corpus can be consulted in the web, but it's not our work. For instance, this site can be consulted. But on the other hand, it may be seen on our machine, and this is what I would like to show you now. Let's open a text. Look for a particular word, it will appear in a sentence and we will never be able to immediately see its context, or the left or right context. But then nobody's perfect, so maybe we'll do that later on. Okay, so what can we do? Let's take a sentence and see how it looks like. On the one hand, we may have a look at the structure. If we are not satisfied with that, we can look into any particular word. So the word form одно corresponds to the lemma один, one, and to the name of the dictionary, meaning один in the sense one. Because один can be either a numeral or an adjective. We can check whether everything is okay. In this case, it turns out that we don't know what particular rule had to be applied in order to to make this system. And perhaps it was done manually, so no particular rule was ready for that. Was ready for that parsing. And in this case, we should either accept that, or accept that, and remember in order to correct the rule or write another rule, or else if we decide that it is not worth doing, just leave it as. It is. We may try and provide lexical functions. In this case, there are no lexical functions. Let me find in this text there are no lexical functions. Let's see what happens here. This is quite an old part of the corpus for which no complex debugging was made. So perhaps we are, so perhaps we could occur, we could come up with a couple of mistakes. We'll try and say check. And indeed, we'll find some mistake. And in this case, the mistake was rather simple, namely, молодой has two meanings. One is young, and the other is the newlywed. And it was not specified which we meant. And as we had the concrete part of speech tagging, it was adjective rather than noun, the system offered this one, which corresponds to the adjective, and we may accept that and say that the sentence is okay. In this case, it's okay. We'll try and find lexical functions. They are not, and we can just, for the sake of completeness, write that this sentence was traced. So this is how we use all that. It is very helpful and very good. On the other hand, it is really hard work. We have not very many people who work with this corpus. This year we only had two young people who worked on the corpus. Therefore, we do not make too much. But after all, you know that in order to maintain and develop the corpus, you need the whole institute, like, for instance, the Czech National Corpus Institute, and we are in no position to have such an enterprise in our system. And maybe one last word. This corpus is in very high demand, at least 12. But then a couple of other enterprises have used it to build statistical parsers on it, using the corpus as the training set of sentences. For instance, we did that together with Joachim Nivre, whom you must know, I believe, that is a Swedish computational linguist in Uppsala, who was quite impressive with this statistical parsing. And within ourselves, we use the corpus for regression tests. So we use that part of the corpus that can be parsed 100% correctly with the help of our parser is put off into one full group of sentences. And then when the parsing rules or the dictionaries change, we sometimes run this set in order to be convinced that nothing's got changed or corrupted, and it is of course it is very often the case that something wrong happened, and we have to correct everything. And this is an absolutely invaluable resource, without which we wouldn't even imagine how we would proceed, because the system is living, and many agents participate in its further development. So the corpus is very good for these things too. And now I really have to finish because I've spoken for too long. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Of these syntactic structures. Is this normalization specific for the target language, or you have just one normalization for the source language, no matter what is the target?
The normalization relates to the source language, always. However, we proceed from the assumption that what we do is more or less of a universal character. So we know that, for instance, strongly governed prepositions exist in every language. And they are different in different languages. So in order to normalize this structure, we get rid of these strongly governed prepositions. So that's it.
Yeah, I understand this intention, but to me, I think it might happen that for typologically different target languages, it might be useful to
yes,
treat the structures differently.
Yeah, actually, that is true. We strive to avoid situations in which we would change the structure of the of a particular language to benefit the target language. We used to do that, but we decided it's theoretically wrong, because who knows what is going to be there later on. Maybe we'll just invent another language pair, so it would be wrong if we just came to meet this language. We used to do that, for instance, when we translated from English to Russian. We tried to do the following. There are relative clauses in English that are used without which or who. The man I saw. And this is absolutely impossible in Russian. So we did within the language the man, and then a node. It's not. It was not exactly who or which would be difficult to do. We just made some general node, more or less close to which, and then it would be translated into Katori, and everything would be okay. But then we thought that it was a wrong idea, and by the way, it is. That's very strange, but it very often happens if you come to a decision that is not principled enough, it will affect your results sooner or later. You are doomed to failure. So if you just make decision that is not principled, it will reflect. It will play. Somehow affect have negative effects. I don't know whether I've answered your question or not.
Thank you. Okay. One more very simple question. If I remember it correctly, there are two types of lexical functions in MTT, syntagmatic ones and paradigmatic ones. And if I understood it correctly, you use only the syntagmatic ones, or at least in these examples.
We use syntagmatic lexical functions in machine translation and corpus, but we use paradigmatic lexical functions in paraphrasing. So, and in paraphrasing, it is very helpful and necessary to use these functions. I may give you a very brief example. We used this quasi-semantic paraphrasing to boost the results of web search. We made a system that consisted worked with so-called parametric nouns. Parametric nouns like height, thickness, length, width, temperature, and so on. And sometimes it is quite difficult to find things in internet because. Or on the web, because in particular for these nouns, for these parametric nouns, because the contexts are too unspecific. For instance, we could say something like the height. Well, how high is the Pisa Tower? Of course, experienced users will not put such a question: how high is the Pisa Tower? They just say height of Pisa Tower, or Pisa Tower height, or whatever. And then it turned out that you can come with the answer that Pisa Tower's height is not very impressive. Okay, that's well right, but it's not the answer to your question. Or else, well, with Pisa Tower, you are bound to find, you are likely to find a question because it's a very familiar object. But if it's not so familiar, then you can search and search and search and not find anything. But if we try to do some quasi-synonymous paraphrasing, we obtain all of a sudden rather better results. Because if we say something like, well, that would be in Russian, but in English, a similar approach could also be conceivable. The height of Pisa Tower is equal to, or reaches, or achieves, and then things like is not very impressive will be out of the question. You will not get these results. So the precision is much higher. And the results were, even with these simple methods, the results were quite okay. This paraphrasing system, of course, used this not only collocations, but also paradigmatic lexical functions.
Thank you. I was wondering about this choice of the number one structure in the process. Well, you said you can have many results of the parsing phase, and then you choose just one. So do you use any statistical methods in this process?
Not for lexical units, never.
Not for
the
lexical
only
units.
Statistical, the only statistical module that we have is the, it's quite an obsolete module that has something to do with bigrams and trigrams, but it's also only for dependencies, not for lexical co-occurrences or whatever. We don't do that.
Okay, so there would be heuristic methods.
Heuristic methods will just introduce collocations. Mm-hmm. We'll say that знакомое лицо is translated as familiar face.
Yeah, okay, and then I wanted to take an issue with the sentence. The meaning of the sentence, the fear of his wife possessed Peter, because I think you can say the fear of his wife possessed Peter too, and then maybe you could interpret it as that Peter is afraid of the same thing as his wife. No?
I would vote against this interpretation. Okay. In English and in Russian that would be different because there are different prepositions. I wouldn't accept
this is,
that. But
this is not very important.
Yeah, but well, it's really interesting. But that would be that. Well, actually, that would be funny if it were possible. Mm-hmm.
Implementation, is your system already used in some commercial products? This is the first question, and the second question is
very precise, we did have some commercial application of the system and a very large scale one. I'll just tell you what it was. There was a company that hosted lots and lots, well, millions of stories that belonged to several important television companies in Russia, like ORT, Russian television, third program, and everything. So there are lots and lots of video materials. Every piece of video material is supplied with a very short, synopsis in Russian. This synopsis is written poorly, very hastily, with lots of mistakes, both linguistic ones, lots of misspellings, typos, and everything like that. However, this company had quite had quite a few queries to that system because, well, what happens? Suppose there is some news, I don't know, maybe some unlucky event that happened somewhere in Perm or whatever, and then they want a picture of that town. It is very likely that their archives would have such material. But if these, and suppose this is some foreign news agency that wants this material. Of course, it can use the language search, writing down Perm or whatever, but it is only in Russian, and many agencies do not know Russian. Maybe they sit elsewhere. So we thought that they thought that it would be good to translate all these synopsises into English. But it was, if I'm not mistaken, 36,000 pages. It was impossible for humans to translate these huge amounts of information. On the other hand, for these particular purposes of search, it is not so very important that the translation is very good, because the keywords should be there. If it is about Perm or Putin or whoever or whatever else, if it is all there, it will serve its purposes. So we translated the whole thing, these 36,000 pages, into English, and this works, and it helps these people. So this was an application. Actually, there exist tasks where machine translation could be of good use. Well, there is only one commercial system. It's called Prompt. I don't think it is good. It is at least a bit better than Google Translation, but it can only be used for very raw developments. Machine translation, the task of machine translation, has not been solved. We have understood it from the start, and we understand it even better now. Parallel. We thought of that. We have some parallel corpus of English and Russian text, but it's not tagged. It would be good to tag it, and perhaps it could be put to good use. And now that we have all the mechanisms, maybe that is quite possible to do, at least within a small on a small scale, so to say, with one student or PhD student or something like that. Thank you. Thank you.